Other works written by this same scholar is a very direct diatribe on war in general and an explanation of its futilities. He obviously was a pacifist of the first order. If I get any philosophical reaction out of it, is that he felt that the development of industry gave people better occupations than being soldiers. He comments on that great numbers of times. And he would thought that peaceable callings might lead them away from more violent life, which was somewhat the habit at that period in world's history.
Mr. Hoover, his specific argument in Book One in this connection is of some interest. He uses the argument of Aristotle, namely that moderation in all things is desirable. He answers the thesis that minds will be exhausted, the ancient thesis, and says that the minds are inexhaustible provided they are used with moderation. Now, since his time, the production of iron has increased something like 800-fold for a population of only 7 or 8 times as many, which means that 100-fold per capita increase in the output of iron. So moderation, Mr. Bryson, has been somewhat forgotten.
Yes,
I think there's an answer to that. Moderation might have been very desirable in the kind of deposits, the grade of ore that they were working at that day and date. You have to remember that our present production of metals comes as the product of cheapening costs, enabling us to work lower and lower grade deposits. So that every time we invent something metallurgically or in mining practice or in pure science that may directly apply, we have lowered the cost of production. We have brought enormous increase in the amount of deposits available, so that a large part of the increased productivity today over 400 years ago is the result of scientific progress to which this man contributed.
He certainly did.
Beside his scientific importance and philosophic dignity, Mr. Hoover, to me, in your translation, there shines through the technicalities some very curious human qualities in this man. I was delighted to discover that he took up the question of the dowsing rod, the fork stick, and rather dismissed it skeptically. Doesn't seem to have thought that it was a very good idea. Well, if I'm not mistaken, there are controversies, in fact, publications going on right now about the dowsing stick, as to whether you can discover metals with a forked rod.
Yes, this book presents the first description of a forked stick for finding metals or water. But George Agricola was very skeptical about it. He gives a great number of reasons why it can't possibly be so. Nevertheless, that myth or that practice or superstition has come right down to today, and we don't need any better evidence than Kenneth Roberts' recent book on the dowsing rod.
I even know an English professor, Mr. Hoover, of great eminence, who, when he goes off into the country, says he can gather ideas as to what's underneath and in the soil with a little fork stick. It's interesting here that just where the English went beyond the Germans in the period following Agricola was with the discovery of the boring rod, with which they actually bored into the earth and brought up examples of the underground material.
But nothing magic about those, Mr. Nett.
No, that was looking at the thing in a more direct way, even in one sense, than Agricola looked at it.
But here, this
as to the forked stick, I might interrupt just a minute. All the geologists and the engineers, in spite of Mr. Kenneth Roberts, will tell you that if you keep away from rocky areas and mountainsides and a few selected places, the earth contains water at every point. You can't miss it if you want to go on down.
Your stick's going to twist wherever you are.
Your stick is going to work everywhere where even the eye would determine that there might not be water. So that Agricola points that out, I may say.
Yes, he's very modern in his knowledge.
But at the same time, he's very medieval in his spirit, too, because at the same, not very far from the passage where he dismisses the still current idea that a forked stick will locate metals and water, he says that in the mines there are many spirits and you have to look out for them. Do miners still think there are spirits in the mines, Mr. Hoover?
Oh, I don't think they do much anymore, but in mining lore over centuries, there was some background for spirits because rocks were... when you open the mine, the rocks fall off of the roof, and you hear sounds and cracks and one thing another, and the miners always attributed those things to some kind of spirit. Most mining lore is filled with benevolent spirits. These noises were supposed to be warnings of accidents that might happen if you didn't look out. And the figures, of which there are a multitude of gnomes and dwarfs and things produced as figures in the mining areas, they are all of them of benevolent aspect.
Mr. Hoover, as late as the time of Robert Boyle, that is to say in the late 17th century, this idea about subterranean spirits and demons was still current. And Robert Boyle thought it worth inquiring of all minds whether they had these demons.
Mm. Today, Mr. Hoover, does a book like this mean anything except in its historical standing?
No, it has no practical value today, although great numbers of the processes which we use today are in principle the same as are illustrated in this book. But nevertheless, our technology has gone far beyond it.
That's characteristic of books and technology, isn't it?
Oh, yes. This was a contribution to the history of a great profession. And as such, it has certain inspirations to the profession.
What makes it endure, wouldn't you say, if it then current, is its certain philosophical implications for the change from ancient mining and metallurgy to modern mining and metallurgy.
It represented the point of revolution into what subsequently became our modern industry from the whole vacuous period of the Middle Ages.
And you could say that this is the, in a sense, the neglected industrial side of the Renaissance. So much is written about the literary, the historical, the artistic side of the Renaissance. Most people don't realize that it had an industrial side.
The whole thing, Mr. Bryson, is of a piece. And that's what we should bring out as historians. History is everything that people do, and it's all interrelated.
Then this contribution that you made, Mr. Hoover, you and Mr. Hoover, is not only a contribution to the history of your own profession, but a contribution to the history of civilization and the record of a landmark in human thought.
You have been listening to Invitation to Learning. Chairman Lyman Bryson had as his guests the Honorable Herbert C. Hoover, former President of the United States, and Dr. John U. Neff, Professor of History at the University of Chicago. The subject of today's discussion was De Re Metallica by Agricola. A printed edition of the first 13 Invitation to Learning broadcasts in 1951 is now on the press. To order your copy of these stimulating discussions, send $1 to cover the cost of printing, handling, and mailing, along with your name and address, to Invitation to Learning, care of the Columbia Broadcasting System, New York 22, New York. Next week, Invitation to Learning will examine the notebooks of Leonardo da Vinci. 2 weeks from today, our subject will be Shakespeare's King Lear. Invitation to Learning is a presentation of the CBS Department of Public Affairs and is produced by George Brothers. The old slogan about putting a lock on the barn door after the horse has been stolen can very well apply to many American families today who regard the threat of attack as a pipe dream, as a warmonger's rumor. Let us pray that America will never be attacked. But let's also be realistic. Let's be prepared. In your community, training in civil defense alertness is now being given. You and your family should participate actively in this alertness campaign. Learn all you can about atomic warfare. Learn protective measures. Learn for your own sake and for the sake of those you love. Start now to cooperate fully with civil defense in your area. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.